Welcome to Speak Up and Stay Alive Radio with author, speaker, and your host, Pat Rulo. Serving you a generous helping of everything you need to know to help you and your loved ones stay safe during any doctor or hospital visit. The program is not intended to replace medical advice from a licensed professional, but rather to encourage you to become a well-informed participant in your health and well-being. And now, your host, Pat Rulo.
My mother had a good death, and I've learned over the years since that when people fight death, they open themselves up to increasingly horrific medical experiences and a lot of pain and unnecessary suffering. So in retrospect, because we didn't try to save my mother and we let her disease take its course, she didn't suffer. She really did not suffer.
Hello and welcome. I'm Pat Rulo, the voice for patient safety and America's radio authority when it comes to healthcare and hospital hazards. And I'm so happy you are here with me. Now, you just heard a snippet from today's guest. I interviewed her for my internet radio station called the Speak Up Talk Radio Network. And I felt that her message about being a caretaker was important to share with you too. So that's coming up. So since our last time together, did you have a good week? I did. I had a lovely experience last Saturday at a speaking event I was invited to. A listener to this show, who attends a Baptist church in Cleveland, invited me to their women's tea as their speaker. Between the music, the genuine and heartfelt sentiment, the beautiful people, the tasty food, I have to say that Bob and I will never forget that experience. So if you're listening, I thank you. And it was during the question and answer period after I spoke that I was asked several questions about pharmaceutical drugs. We talked about antibiotics. And as much as I hated to break the positivity of the day, I did have to share the fact that big pharma, big government, big medicine, and big people are not looking out for us. So that inspired today's upcoming healthcare hazard. And if you know me, you know I'm not a fan of wasting time or words. So let's just head into it, shall we? Because right now, it's time for the healthcare hazard of the week. Here's a recent headline on Friday, April the 22nd, 2016, in an article by Mike Adams, the Health Ranger. The headlines read, "Former FDA Commissioner Margaret Hamburg named in a massive conspiracy and racketeering lawsuit involving Johnson & Johnson, a Wall Street hedge fund, and the antibiotic drug called Levaquin." And I ask, do any of these people have a horse in that race? Well, before we answer that question, let me back up for a moment. Fluoroquinolones are the most widely used type of antibiotic in the United States, and more than 26 million Americans take them in some form every year. Doctors prescribe them to treat a number of illnesses, including respiratory and urinary tract infections. Now, in some cases, these medications are life-saving, but they do harbor some serious side effects. Studies link these drugs to damage in the lining of the aorta, the largest blood vessel in the body. Evidence suggests that fluoroquinolones can cause two kinds of damage to the aorta, either dissection, which means tears, or aneurysms, bulging, or enlargement. These conditions weaken the walls of the aorta and may lead to leaks or ruptures, which can be fatal. These drugs are also linked to permanent painful nerve damage called peripheral neuropathy and tendon ruptures that can leave people disabled. The most popular antibiotics in this class are Cipro, Levaquin, and Avalox. Medical experts expect the demand for antibacterial drugs to keep growing, and they estimate by 2019, the class will generate more than $7 billion in revenue for drug manufacturers. And I've talked about these drugs before. I talked about the drug Cipro, which I took unknowingly, caused ringing in my ears that has not gone away to this day. I had a guest on the show who runs a website called Floxy Hope. Why is it called Floxy Hope? Because she refers to this class of drugs as fluoroquinolone toxicity syndrome or floxing. So we've discussed this a bit before, but let's get back to the headline. Former FDA Commissioner Margaret Hamburg, named in a massive conspiracy and racketeering lawsuit involving Johnson & Johnson, a Wall Street hedge fund, and the Levaquin drug. In this Natural News article, they say the former head of the FDA, Margaret Hamburg, used the federal agency to run a massive conspiracy of racketeering and fraud in order to generate millions of dollars in drug company profits for her husband's hedge fund firm, according to a lawsuit filed in the United States District Court for the District of Columbia. The lawsuit alleges that while acting as FDA commissioner, Hamburg engaged in a wide-ranging conspiracy to approve an extremely dangerous drug known to cause severe and even deadly side effects in order to financially benefit her husband's hedge fund, which held very large financial positions in Johnson & Johnson, makers of the drug. Stating that she operated a criminal conspiracy at least between the years of 2009 and 2015 to fraudulently suppress warnings about the devastating effects of Levaquin. And if you remember, I also exposed Johnson & Johnson a few weeks ago, claiming to be a family company, hoping you'll think they're referring to your family, when in fact it's their family of cronies. Remember, I shared the hazards associated with Johnson's baby powder and how talc was found to be a contributing factor to ovarian cancer, among other troubling conditions. Well, to further this conspiracy, Hamburg appointed officials of Johnson & Johnson to key FDA advisory committees and colluded with Johnson & Johnson and its officials and subsidiaries to suppress information about the dangerous and deadly effects of Levaquin. And as a result, during her tenure as the FDA commissioner, over 5,000 people died as a result of consuming Levaquin and other dangerous drugs promoted, manufactured, marketed, and distributed and sold by Johnson & Johnson. And this deadly harm is continuing as thousands of other people are suffering and dying from the highly dangerous effects of Levaquin. Now, a fascinating finding in the lawsuit alleges that Hamburg bribed her way into the top position at the FDA by making large financial contributions to Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama and failed to disclose to Congress and other relevant authorities her and her husband's clear-cut conflict of interest, specifically that Renaissance Technologies, LLC, held hundreds of millions of dollars of Johnson & Johnson stock, the manufacturer of the deadly drug Levaquin. And according to the article, they say from what we now know about the Clinton Foundation's deep financial ties to Big Pharma and Wall Street hedge funds, none of this comes as any sort of a surprise. In fact, while these allegations may have been easily dismissed as quote-unquote conspiracy theory back in 2008, so much more awakening is happening among the American public that they are now likely to be understood as an actual conspiracy being carried out among the political and financial elite who routinely conspire against the people in order to enrich themselves. And it's not like Hamburg was unaware of the problem. Two Pennsylvania senators requested more FDA warning labels on Levaquin in 2010. Dr. Charles Bennett, oncologist and researcher at the Southern Network on Adverse Reactions at the University of South Carolina, filed two citizen petitions to Hamburg's FDA back in 2014, urging further labeling to warn of possible cell damage and neurodegenerative diseases like Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, and Huntington's disease also associated with Levaquin. Hamburg also received hundreds of emails from people who had severe health problems from taking Levaquin, but did nothing, the complaint claims. And while Hamburg was FDA commissioner, her husband's annual income increased from a reported $10 million in 2008 to an estimated $125 million in 2011, due in whole or part to Hamburg's racketeering conspiracy to withhold information about the devastating, life-threatening, and deadly effects of Levaquin. Now, as part of Hamburg's pattern and practice of acting illegally outside of the scope of her authority as the FDA commissioner, she also counseled the FDA to approve another highly dangerous pharmaceutical drug that her husband's Renaissance Technology also owns stock in, called Zohydro, despite the fact that the FDA advisory committee voted 11-2 against its approval. But she personally testified to members of Congress that she supported Zohydro's approval. Wonder why. Well, now on November 5th, 2015, after Hamburg had resigned, an FDA employee, Deborah Boxwell, finally exposed to the public at large that Hamburg and the FDA had been aware that Levaquin may result in a multi-system disability since 2013, but that it did nothing to add this information to the Levaquin label, but instead conspired with other defendants to fraudulently withhold it. It is a tragic testament to how corrupt companies like Johnson & Johnson and their officials bribe and illegally collude with government officials and line their pockets at the expense of innocent people. People who just, by the way, they are paid to protect. And now that she's gone and these lawsuits are mounting, the FDA finally says the risks may outweigh the benefits for antibiotics, Levaquin, Cipro, and others. Yep, that's right. Just a few weeks ago, on May 12th, 2016, the United States Food and Drug Administration announced it is requiring a stronger black box warning for these common popular antibiotics called fluoroquinolones that include Levaquin, Cipro, and Avalox, medications taken by more than 26 million Americans each year. The FDA now says and is advising that these serious side effects associated with fluoroquinolones generally outweigh the benefits for patients with sinusitis, bronchitis, and uncomplicated urinary tract infections who have other treatment options. For these patients, they say, fluoroquinolones should be reserved for those who do not have alternative options. Well, my point in disclosing this to you is simple. I want you to be aware of the very real fact that no one is looking out for you. Our representatives could either care less unless they are getting paid, or if they do care, their voice is so small that they simply cannot make a difference. So it's up to us, the people, the masses, to become informed, to speak up, to band together. Come on, there's more of us out there than there are them, so why do we tolerate this wanton and corrupt behavior at our expense? The next time you are prescribed an antibiotic, make sure it does not belong to the fluoroquinolone family, and if it does, ask over and over again, why do I need this particular drug? Is there anything else that will solve my problem that won't kill me in the process? Ask, hey doc, what about the new FDA warning that says the risks outweigh the rewards? Please, don't just pop anything into your mouth anymore. Do not allow someone else, and I don't care if he or she is a doctor, do not blindly accept what is told to you as the only truth. It may be his or her truth, but it very well may not be yours. Remember, this radio program, the title of this program, you have to speak up and stay alive. And hey, if you want some no-nonsense advice and information, invite me to speak to your group too. I have no horse in the race.
Listen to Pat Rulo and Speak Up and Stay Alive Radio. Stay safe from little-known healthcare and hospital hazards. To learn more, go to speakupandstayalive.com. That's speakupandstayalive.com.
Welcome to the Speak Up Talk Radio Network. I'm your hostess, Pat Rulo. We bring you hand-selected hosts, podcasts, and talk radio programming with listening options, 24/7 streaming, or listen on demand. We also feature one-on-one segments with important guests, people who have something to say that you need to hear. Visit speakuptalkradio.com. And today I have a guest with a message that resonates with me, as both she and I have been long-term caregivers for our moms. Caregiving and all that comes with it is not something we are taught how to do or how to deal with. So right now, we are going to gain some insight from our guest, Dr. Virginia Simpson. Virginia is known to her clients as Dr. Ginny, and she is a nationally and internationally recognized authority on dying and grieving. She is a bereavement care specialist and an executive counseling director for hundreds of funeral homes throughout the United States and Canada. She is the founder of the Morningstar Center for Grieving Children and Their Families, which she ran from 1995 to 2005, and is the author of the memoir, The Space Between, about her journey caring for her ailing mother. Virginia has appeared on numerous television and radio programs. She holds a fellowship in thanatology from the Association of Death Education and Counseling and has been honored for her work by the cities of Indian Wells, Palm Desert, Palm Springs, and Rancho Mirage. She lives in El Dorado Hills, California, with her husband, Bob, and her golden retriever, Shelby. And there is so much more to know about our special guest, so let's get started. Welcome to the show, Virginia.
Well, thank you for having me, Pat. I appreciate it.
Well, as I said, this is a topic that's close to my heart. And since there's so much to talk about, I was thinking maybe we'd separate it into two segments. First, I'd like to talk about your book, and later maybe we can get into your perspective and advice on grief and the grieving process.
That sounds very good.
Excellent. All righty. So let's talk about your book, The Space Between, a memoir of mother-daughter love at the end of life, as it takes readers along the 6 years that you were your mom's caretaker. And I love this sentence that I believe was on the Amazon description. It said, "In the space between, Simpson takes readers along for the journey as she struggles to bridge the invisible, often prickly space that sits between so many mothers and daughters, and to give voice to the challenges, emotions, and thoughts many caregivers experience but are too ashamed to admit." And I can attest to that as I've looked after my ailing mom going on 9 years now, and the words prickly space hit me and kind of says it all. So why don't you tell us about the journey that led to the writing of the book?
Oh, well, I started writing after my mother had been dead a number of years, and the story seemed to have a life of its own, and I needed to follow all the threads it was taking me on. I learned so much more about my mother through this writing than I realized while she was alive, things that I wish I had been able to see and understand at the time. Caretaking is so difficult. When you become your parent's parent, it's not fun. And although my mother and I had had a very good relationship before her life-threatening illness necessitated she come live with me, once she was in my house, it's as though everything that had ever stood between us was there again, and we had to deal with it. And even though at the end of the book my mother dies, I believe it's not a sad story because our journey ends with nothing but pure love between us. And I believe that occurred because we kept talking to each other. We kept communicating. And so I think that's just an important message from everyone is keep that conversation open, no matter how difficult the relationship.
I so appreciate your honesty where you're saying that what it's not easy and it is difficult and all the old wounds come back, because I think so many of us who are caregiving are afraid to be honest in the fear that, oh, maybe we'll seem like a bad daughter or a bad son if we acknowledge those feelings.
I know exactly what you're saying. And then there's also the feelings you have as a caretaker, because it wears you down.
It does.
You are so worn out and frazzled, and your temper is quicker. You don't have the patience that you used to have. And then because you know the person you love, it's the end of their life, you want yourself to be more patient, and you can be. I was very hard on myself, and I put that down on the page because I wanted to give voice to people to know that it's okay not to be the perfect person, to have not have perfect feelings. We all have that. You're caught in this horrible feeling of wanting this to be over because you're being tortured, but over means the person you love has to die, and that's just a horrifying thought because you really don't want them dead. You just want them healthy again, and that can't happen. It's heartbreaking. It really is heartbreaking.
It is a very difficult situation, and you just pinpointed it. I mean, you just put it in a tiny little nutshell. I'm feeling the same emotions right now, so I'm so appreciative of what you're saying and hoping that folks that are listening can, if they're not a caretaker now, put this in the back of their brain and save it for future use. I was going to ask you if you thought you could have written that book while your mom was still alive.
I absolutely could not have written the book while she was alive. I needed to age a little bit myself and have time to really reflect from a new perspective that I could not have had while I was still somebody's daughter. Mm-hmm. I had to see the relationship with my mother, which I was able to do better because there was no new incoming information that could get in our way. Mm-hmm. So I could see her with such clarity. I could understand her as a woman separate from being my mother, who had her own life and her own challenges. And I could see how the things that happened to her during her life affected her and impacted who she was and how she related to other people and to me. I couldn't have seen that while she was alive.
Mm-hmm. And in some respects, it brings you closer to her after the fact. And then that's kind of a strange feeling, too, to think that you feel closer to someone when they're not here.
There's nothing in the way of us anymore.
Yeah.
There's nothing to get in the way. But there really wasn't by the time she died. My mother became pure love, and it was a remarkable transformation to see. I was so honored to watch her grow. And I can only hope when it's my turn to be at the end of my life, if I could only have one-tenth of the courage I saw her have and one-tenth of that dignity, I'd be doing really well.
Oh,
I just came to so admire her.
Wow, you're bringing tears to my eyes as we speak here. So your book really can help others who are caretakers for their parents. Now, when you wrote this, did you write it with readers in mind, or was it more of a cathartic act for you and your well-being?
It turned out to be a combination of both, but I definitely had readers in mind. As an expert in death, dying, and bereavement, I put certain things into the story very intentionally because I wanted people to have that information, to know about getting into hospice, to understand what hospice can do if you get into it early enough so that you can have the benefits of it. I wanted them to understand the conversations you need to have. I wanted the real feelings and emotions to be on the page, to give people permission to be human. I did these things with great intention, knowing that some people might say, gosh, she's kind of complaining. I wasn't. I intentionally put it on the page because I wanted people to see. I was the expert, but my expertise really flew out the window when my mother came and lived with me. I was just a person's daughter, and I was thrown into something I had personally never experienced before, which was being a caretaker, which was watching my mother dying. Mm-hmm. And there was nothing I could do to stop that.
Yeah.
Nothing. And in a way, I'm glad we didn't try to stop it because my mother had a good death. And I've learned over the years since that when people fight death, they open themselves up to increasingly horrific medical experiences and a lot of pain and unnecessary suffering. So in retrospect, because we didn't try to save my mother and we let her disease take its course, she didn't suffer. She really did not suffer.
Just as a side, what did she pass away from?
My mother had congestive heart failure and emphysema.
Same as mine. Very interesting. I had that feeling when you were speaking. That's what we're going through right now. Very interesting. Now, we mentioned the word conversation earlier. Given that you had this amount of time, I'm sure there were many important conversations. And I'd like to talk about some of those conversations that one should have with a person prior to them passing away or when they're in the process of death. Let's talk about those conversations.
Okay. Well, fortunately, back in the 80s, I took a class on the psychology of aging, and I had a conversation with my mother then about what she would like at the end of her life, and we got her to fill out the necessary documents. So when the time came that we needed this information, we'd already had the conversation. Some of the conversations that came up while she was with me was when I found out that I could get her into hospice much earlier than I had realized. And I had to go home and say, Mom, I'd like to get you into hospice. And no, it's not that I think you only have 6 months to live. I just want to get you better care. Mm-hmm. And fortunately, she trusted me enough to allow me to do this. And she didn't fight it. She didn't argue with it. And we got such excellent care because of that.
Mm-hmm.
The conversations about what she wanted after she died, so that she could make the arrangements for exactly what she wanted to have happen with her body. I didn't have to make that decision for her. I didn't have to be confused. I knew what she wanted, and I made sure that that was taken care of. So you need to know how they want to die. Who do they want around them? What do they want said to them, not said to them? I mean, one of the things I asked my mother, we were a stoic family, and we were not to cry. So I said to my mom, Mom, when it's the end of your life, is it okay if I cry?
Oh.
And she thought about it. She says, yeah, I think that'd be just fine. Because if I hadn't asked, I would have sat at her bedside while she was at the end of her life and probably been stuffing down lots of emotions.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't have to do that because she had given me permission. The other thing that I knew, because I'd done some research, which I think is very important, I knew my mother would not have me in the room when she died. A lot of people think, because they had to step out of the room for a minute and the person dies, they go, oh, if I'd only stayed there. Mm-hmm. And then they feel guilty. But sometimes the person dying needs for us not to be in the room with them. So I knew beyond a shadow of a doubt, I didn't have to ask my mother, I knew she'd never have me in the room with her. And believe me, I wasn't out of that room more than 2 minutes when she died.
Interesting, huh?
After I'd been sitting with her for hours.
Oh. Again, I could relate back to when my dad passed away and my mom called and said, you know, dad's dying. He's in the act right now of dying. And I didn't get there in time. And obviously he didn't want me to be there.
No. And it's not against you, but sometimes, you know, parents are so used to protecting us.
Yes.
In many ways. And that just doesn't end.
Mm-hmm.
So I just knew. I knew my mother. I knew her.
So the point is to have these conversations earlier rather than not.
Don't wait till you need to have them. Don't wait until there's a crisis. You need to get all your documents ready. You need to talk to the people you love. And fortunately now there is so much more available than when I went through this. So there's lots of things that can help you.
Excellent. All right. And obviously your book can really help as well. Now you had other family members that were close to you pass away. How did that impact you or the writing of the book at all?
Well, I was very surprised. My father died when I was 12, and although I knew his death impacted my whole life, in the writing of the book, it got even clearer to me. He was everywhere in that book.
Hmm.
He was everywhere in our lives, even though he had died so long ago. And in fact, there's a funny scene in the book. I had to cut my mother's toenails one day. And I'd never done that before. So here I am clipping away, and all of a sudden she goes, God damn you! And I dropped her foot, thinking, oh my God, did I hurt her? And she was looking up at a picture of my father, and she said, damn you for dying young. Yeah.
Wow.
And heartbreaking.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. And it was huge on her, but that was the second husband she lost.
Mm-hmm.
Her first husband died when she was only 32, and he was only 33 years old.
Oh my.
So in the writing, to see the impact these kind of deaths could have had on a young woman,
mm-hmm,
who have lost two husbands,
mm-hmm,
and been widowed most of her life, opened my eyes and my heart to her. She did not have it easy.
No, doesn't sound it. But she did in a way because she had you. Got to look at that point. So
I hope so.
Yeah. So let's spend a little bit of time talking about grief. Is grief processed differently depending on the age of the person who is grieving and maybe perhaps the age or relationship of the person who is passed? Or is there a universal act in a process of grieving?
Well, I think each person grieves individually, but it's similar. And I know for myself that each time I grieve, it's not exactly the same. With my mother, it was what I would call disenfranchised grief. Because people would say, how old was she? And when I'd say, well, she was almost 91, they'd go, oh, she was old, she had a good life. And then they'd walk away, and I'd be thinking to myself, yes, but I've never lived without her. I have to learn how to live without her.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we have to be mindful that when somebody loses a person that they love, no matter who it is, no matter what age, the loss is big at that time. Because the grief is huge when we lose somebody we love, whether it be a parent, a child, a husband, a pet.
Yes.
When it happens, we have to feel the pain, and it's big. Now, one of the differences that they found in studies for older people, and I'm talking about people probably in their 80s or 90s, when they have a loss, they're not as motivated to go through the whole grieving process. Because they don't have the time.
They don't have time, yeah.
So they kind of might want to just get on with their life and not have to feel too many things. That's been found. But for most of us, we're going to cry. We're going to be surprised by what's been called grief bursts. You think you're doing just fine, and all of a sudden it's like you're punched in the stomach, all the air's out of you, and all you could do is cry. I was surprised when my mother died that all of a sudden I was a little girl. Because mommy wasn't there. I actually heard myself cry out, mommy. And I hadn't called my mother mommy since I was tiny.
Yeah.
And yet that part was there because for the first time in my life, I was an orphan.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a new world to walk in, to realize I was nobody's child anymore.
Oh. Wow, there's a sense of relief on the one hand, and then that sense of like abandonment on the other.
Well, it was a different experience, but I still went through all the pain and I went through guilt all
yes.
of a sudden, and this is so natural. The person who's died becomes a saint.
Mm-hmm.
And when we start going over things that happened, like, why wasn't I more patient? Why wasn't I this, da-da-da-da? And then I'd say to myself, now, let's back that bus up. Let's look at the other side of that conversation. She wasn't easy.
Yes.
Don't be so hard on yourself. But it's so, you hear people, they will idealize the person who died on one hand and then tell you a bad story about the person who died and can't seem to reconcile that the person wasn't a saint. I hear this in my work all the time with people I'm listening to who are grieving. They idealize the person who's died, and nobody can live up to that idealization.
That's so interesting, because I have given thought to that, like some of the irritating things that my mom does. I even said this to my daughters the other day. I said, you know what, we're going to look back at this and think this wasn't irritating, it was endearing. And it's just exactly what you're saying.
A different perspective. And there's a book by Deborah Tannen called You're Wearing That, which is about mother-daughter communication. I really recommend it because it would have been very helpful to me to have read that book, but it had not been written when my mother was alive.
All right. It's called You're Wearing That. I could just hear that.
About how mothers say something and they mean well, and the daughter's going,
like,
she's criticizing
me. Oh, my gosh, how horrible. I understand it. I understand it. So we're talking about grieving of, say, like family members that maybe have come of age that we would expect. But what about violent and sudden deaths, such as school shootings? How is that grieving process the same or different?
Well, it depends on the relationship people have with who died.
Mm-hmm.
That's really important. I cringe when I hear on the news that there's been a shooting or something in a school or a parent has died, and all of a sudden, quote, grief counselors rush in.
Yes.
They should not.
Mm-hmm.
They should not rush in right away, because generally the school will be able to take care of it, and it's only the kids who are really close who may have ongoing problems who need to be attended to by grief counselors. But what happens is there are some people who over-identify, who might not even known people who were killed, might not have even been there, but when everybody rushes in to do too much, it becomes bigger in their mind.
Yes.
And there's some people that will happen to.
That is a very interesting point. So who would you suggest would need grief counseling? Would a person know that they need that?
In general, grief is going to look a certain way, but it's when it's persistent and it's in the intensity. If you know, in the beginning, you're kind of numb, and that isn't even a good enough word. I think chaos is a better thing. Everything just doesn't even quite make sense. So eventually that should start to lift and allow for the more painful aspects of the grieving, where you're really feeling what's going on, where you're really acknowledging this has happened and it's not going to change. Now, if the person is still in magical thinking that they could bring the person back,
mm-hmm.
they're not dealing with the feelings, they're hiding, they're running from it, then we might have a problem that needs to be addressed. But initially, most people are going to feel the same kinds of things. So it's only if it becomes persistent and really intense that we need to start being concerned.
Okay. All right.
Having said that, I think children benefit tremendously from getting into groups with other children.
Oh, really?
I think so, and especially grief camps.
Okay. Tell us a bit about that.
Well, they might go on once or twice a year, and then the kids get to go and be with other children who've experienced a loss, and they get to play. They get to talk about their feelings, act out their feelings through play, do artwork, and have some fun and some laughs while they're getting a perspective on their loss. It's the one place they're not going to be the odd child.
Okay.
And that's really important to know, that it does happen to other people. Children need to know they didn't do anything to deserve it. Every child I've ever met thinks that somehow they caused the death by something they did or didn't do.
Oh, wow.
And they need to know that things just happen. And they're not a bad child. They're not a doomed child. It's just that something bad happened. And we need to feel it, and we need to express it.
I know there's some hospices that have counseling for children after the fact.
They do. I would caution people, though, when they get into grief groups from anybody, to look into the credentials of the people who are leading the groups.
Mm-hmm.
This is very important, because sometimes it's just lay people. Sometimes it'll be people who just went through a quick training but haven't had the years of experience. Because I think what's important as we do the work, and it's been important to me, is it was just as important for me to know what I do know as it was for me to understand what I don't know.
What you don't know. I get it. Mm-hmm. It's like anything else. You need to do a little due diligence and make sure whoever is leading the group has the background and the proper training to do so.
And ongoing training.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because things change. We're learning new things all the time. So you have to stay up to date with what's going on.
Now, you have a very particularly interesting line on your website, and you say, don't waste the pain. Let's talk about that. I liked it.
Mm-hmm. I figure this. If you have to be in the depths of misery, pay attention. This is what I tell my clients. In every painful experience, they're awful, but there's gifts if we pay attention. Mm-hmm. So pay attention how you get back up again. Pay attention to what you're learning that allows you to find your smile again. Because these are things that are going to help you during the rest of your life when you go through tough times. And we all of these have tough times that come up. So pay attention. There are gifts in grief. It teaches us to really love the people who are here, to really celebrate the days that we're alive, the days that we're not in any kind of pain or anguish. We no longer can take everything for granted that it's always going to be good. We know it's not. So we have to enjoy those days and really celebrate our lives while we can.
I love that when I read that, don't waste the pain. And then you had another line that I really gravitated toward. You talked about fast food grieving. Tell us what
yes,
you mean by
I did.
Fast food grieving.
Yes, that's because we are a fast food society. We want people well right away. I remember watching TV many years ago. There had been a plane crash, and it was about 2 weeks later, and people were coming to the site of the crash, and they said, and these people are still grieving. And I kind of yelled at the TV, and I said, still grieving? They haven't even started grieving. And we think people should be over it so fast. Well, we never get over our losses. We learn to live with them. They become part of who we are. But in our society, we want people to hurry up, mm-hmm. get it done, get on with their lives. And it doesn't work that way. It absolutely does not work that way. We need to understand it takes as long as it takes.
Mm-hmm. There's nothing wrong with that.
Not a thing. Yeah. I wish people never apologized for crying.
Yeah. Well, maybe they won't after this conversation.
I hope so.
Yes. Now, you work with funeral homes, too. Tell us about that.
If you go onto the funeral homes that I'm with, I created a group of videos that people can click on and they can listen to me talking about various topics.
That makes so much sense.
Yes, yes. So it's really beneficial to them. It's based on a lot of research I did. It's based on people that I saw and knowing what they went through. Mm-hmm. And that I've learned more from the people I've worked with than any book has ever been able to teach me.
Sure, I understand that. So you work with funeral homes throughout the country?
Yes,
okay.
I do.
Now, you have a private practice that reaches out to those who are grieving. Tell us how your services can help.
I can help people who have lost anybody because I've been part of that. I've worked with people, children as young as 3 years old. I've worked with teenagers. I've worked with adults. I've worked with parents who've lost children, children who've lost parents, spouses who've had those losses. Any kind of loss, I've lost people, worked with people who've had somebody die through murder, through suicide, accidents, long-term illnesses. So anything doesn't throw me because I've listened to people throughout these years hear their stories.
And can you work with folks outside of California?
No, I really cannot.
Okay.
That would be, you have to be licensed in each state. You have to be authorized in each state.
Mm-hmm.
So if somebody from outside the state contacts me, I might do something really brief, but mostly what I'm doing is finding out where they're located, and then I do some research to find out resources in their area who can help them.
Okay, good. I wanted to clarify that. I didn't know if it was something you could do over the phone or if it was an in-person and more of a local service.
I prefer in person mm-hmm. because there's a lot of information people give us through their body language that you cannot, and through what their eyes, their facial expressions, you can't see those things over the phone.
Thank you for saying that. I find the same parallel with doctors when they're working with patients that don't look at the patient. They're so busy documenting things that they're missing 90% of the diagnostic heads up that they can be getting if they actually looked at the person's face and their eyes.
Absolutely. Words are only a small part of the conversation.
For sure. Well, what's next for Dr. Virginia Simpson?
Well, right now I'm doing book launches. This Saturday, I'm actually going to be speaking at a group church function for about 50 women, and we're going to be talking about the subject, talking about death won't kill you.
Oh, that's a good topic.
It's a very important topic because there's so much information now that can be very helpful to us. You want to have your documents ready. You want to have those conversations. And like I said earlier, there's things that can help us have it. There is something called the Go Wish Game, which is a deck of cards. And this is through, this helps you to tell your family members what's important to you and what you want them to know at the end of your life, how you want to be taken care of. There's also, through Aging with Dignity, 5 Wishes, which is a nice companion to your advanced care directive because it also talks about how you want people to treat you and what you want the loved ones to know. What haven't you told them that you want them to know? How much you love them? What things are important to you? So we're going to be talking about those things on Saturday, and I think it's a very important conversation. I've recently learned that when doctors are given a terminal diagnosis, you know what they do?
No.
They go home.
Huh.
They don't undergo that massive amount of treatment.
Yep.
So I think they know something.
I agree. We've just been through that with my mom with the do not resuscitate. At any risk, are you willing to do that? And at what point are you not? You've got this tiny little frail body. Are we really going to be pounding on you, breaking ribs to try to get you to breathe when you're, 87 years old and have all of these comorbidities? It's kind of an interesting time.
The truth is that only on TV does it really work well to do CPR.
Mm-hmm.
It will not work well for an elderly person who is sick.
Yep.
The outcome could be horrific, not just the breaking of the bones to get her to be resuscitated, but afterwards, even if she did live, it would not be pleasant.
No.
And people need to know that. It's not like TV.
No, it's not like TV, and I had that conversation with my mom, and yet the staff around this rehab home, it was just like, here's the paper. It's like, wow, there's no conversation that goes with that needed to be.
There needs to be that conversation.
It does.
With hospice, we had the DNR, the Do Not Resuscitate on the refrigerator, and they explained to me that if my mother went into cardiac arrest to call them, not to call the paramedics, because here's something that was frightening to me. If they came, and even if my mother was already dead, they would have to try to resuscitate her.
Yes, if she was a full code, if she was the full rescue code and hadn't signed that prior.
So this is not something you want. I think people think, well, where there's life, there's hope, and that's not always the truth.
Mm-hmm. No,
it's not always the truth.
I found that interesting what you said at the beginning, where folks have a more peaceful death if they don't choose to do all of those, last-minute measures that might keep them alive.
Well, for example, if a person has dementia, Alzheimer's, feeding tubes are horrible.
Yes.
You're actually better off hand-feeding somebody than trying to get them to use a feeding tube. Mm-hmm. The feeding tubes will lead to your loved one suffering. But so many families believe that they have to keep nurturing the person, and they're not understanding. Food is not life at this point. It's torture.
And that's why we need healthcare providers maybe to step up to the plate and be able to have these conversations. It's kind
exactly,
of
but they're not trained to do that. They're getting more training now, but not all of them are trained. So we have to learn the right questions to ask. For example, if you say, Doc, can you save me? Yes, I can save you. Well, what are the risks of the surgery you want to do? Here's the risks. But the question you really need to say is, if you do these things and if I take all these risks, am I going to be able to do the things I love? I love to play golf. Am I going to be able to play golf? Am I able to be in the kitchen and cooking? Am I going to be able to get in my car and drive and have freedom? Am I going to be able to hike? What if those answers are no? Mm-hmm. Would you have a different response to the treatments you want to have?
Right.
They might be. So you need to know to ask the right questions.
We need to be empowered and have
exactly.
that educational piece.
And I know people don't want to think of it. It's too horrible to think about. Yes, it's horrible to think about, but it would be a lot more horrible to think about it if you were in the situation where it meant your life or death. Learn about it now while you're healthy enough so when and if the time comes, you at least have some tools. I mean, you wouldn't go on a vacation without considering where you were going and what you needed to pack.
Yep.
And yet we don't prepare for this huge journey.
Right, that we knew was going to be happening from the very moment we were born. So it's not a surprise.
Well, it is a surprise, though. I mean, it actually is to all of us. And I think most of us feel like Woody Allen, that they're not afraid of dying. They just don't want to be there when it happens.
All right, we'll find a little humor in that.
You have to.
I know you do. Oh, Virginia, is there anything then you'd like to talk about that we missed today?
I don't think there's really anything that we've actually missed. All I could say is if you find yourself in the position of being a caregiver, learn about all the resources in your community. You can get help, you can get respite, and you're going to need to have that respite. Don't expect yourself to be everything to the person you're caretaking. And I think my book, The Space Between, A Memoir of Mother-Daughter Love at the End of Life, can actually help you understand what may be ahead of you. And even if you've been through it, I think it'll give voice to the experience you've had.
And I agree. So direct us, where can folks learn more about you, and then where can they purchase your book?
Well, I have two websites. One is virginiaasimpson.com, and the other is drvirginiasimpson.com. You can find my book wherever you can buy books online, Amazon, Barnes & Noble. There's other resources. Usually local bookstores can order books for you. So anywhere you can find a book, you should be able to find my book.
Excellent. So the websites, again, are drvirginiasimpson.com and or virginiaasimpson.com. And I strongly encourage everyone listening to get a copy of the book, The Space Between, A Memoir of Mother-Daughter Love at the End of Life. And you can find that at Amazon. Head over to Virginia's websites. And if you're in the Northern California area, contact Dr. Virginia Simpson if you're looking for grief counseling or a grief and death specialist. Virginia, this has been a very special day for me. You've given me a little sense of and relief and hope. So I so appreciate having you here today. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much, Pat, and I'm so glad that my words could be of help to you.
Do you or a loved one need to rehabilitate after a hospital stay and don't know where to go? With so many choices, how do you safely choose? Well, I have the answer. The Welsh Home, located in Rocky River, Ohio. Let's spend the next 2 minutes with Lauren Teschner to get some advice. Welcome, Lauren.
Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. Lauren, how does the Welsh Home help patients transition back home?
We establish goals on day one of them admitting to the Welsh Home and make sure that they can reach those goals before they go home. And we do that through physical therapy, occupational therapy, speech therapy, nursing needs, and also the social work piece of it. We have a social worker on staff who's going to make sure that the patient is safe to go home, make sure that they have all the equipment in their home that they're going to need once they return home, and make sure that it's going to be a successful transition. We would never want to transition someone back to their home that we knew was not going to succeed. So we want to make sure that we do our best to accomplish their goals for a safe return home.
Thank you so much, Lauren.
You're welcome.
The Welsh Home offers state-of-the-art skilled rehabilitation therapy on-site to meet the individual needs of each and every resident. Whether you are looking for short-term or long-term care, the Welsh Home can help. And you don't have to be Welsh to call the Welsh Home your home. Call them to arrange for a tour. 440-331-0420. That's 440-331-0420. Or visit welshhome.com. Well, my friends, we did it again. We reached the end of our time together, and always goes so fast. Wish we had more time to speak, but you can always invite me to come to your group, your club, business, church, hospital, wherever people gather, I will be glad to join you and share some more healthcare and hospital and patient safety tips. Just give me a call, 440-725-5462. 440-725-5462, and we can discuss the few details and make plans for us to get together. And until that time, head over to the website, speakupandstayalive.com, speakupandstayalive.com, and that is where you can get a copy of the book, Speak Up and Stay Alive, The Patient Advocate Hospital Survival Guide. It truly is your guide to a safe healthcare and hospital journey. Bring the book to the hospital, lay it on the tray table. Again, it is a conversation starter, and that's what you want. People walk in the room, take a look at the cover, and say, "What's that all about?" And now it opens up the lines of communication where you could now say, "Hey, I'm concerned about healthcare-acquired infections. I'm concerned about MRSA and C. diff, bed sores, medication errors." And now the folks that come into your room know that you're just a little bit different than the guy or gal down the hall. So get a copy of that book. It's $20, the best $20 you'll ever spend. SpeakUpAndStayAlive.com. All right, we really do have to go, so be sure to come back next week. You know me, I always have lots for you. Same time, same place, but never the same information. Until then, I hope you have a healthy and a happy week, free from anyone who has a horse in the race and dangerous antibiotics. I am Pat Rulo, and I am your guide to safe and successful healthcare and hospital encounters.
Listen to Pat Rulo and Speak Up and Stay Alive Radio. Stay safe from little-known healthcare and hospital hazards. To learn more, go to speakupandstayalive.com. That's speakupandstayalive.com.
Make a splash with a season pass that screams fun. Pioneer Waterland and Drive Fun Park in Chardon, Ohio has discounted season passes. Family pass for $4, $195. Order your season passes today at pioneerwaterland.com or by phone 440-285-5200. That's 440-285-5200.